out there. You know, it's a fantastic day, and it's going to get even more wonderful.
More fantasticker.
Yeah, even more fantasticker with stickers on it. Have a nice day, stickers.
That's right.
Yeah. KBOO, 90.7 FM. That's what you're listening to. Abe Proctor, that's the other voice. Joe Uris. That's me. It's talk radio.
Yeah, we got a lot. We got a full plate today.
Oh, we do. Greg Palast is going to be with us.
One of my favorite expatriate journalists.
Yeah.
Out of all that I know.
You know, Gore Vidal is in town. He's an expatriate writer. Maybe we should move to, like, where?
Paris.
Paris, yeah. Of course. Oh, no, those Parisians, they're so selfish. 231-8187, they want jobs, can you imagine? And they're smart enough to go into the streets to get them. Oh, disgusting. What is wrong with those French? Woo! All right. Hey, we got so much.
We do.
Should we start with Blackwater?
Yeah, let's start with Blackwater.
Okay, The Nation, big article. Really, you know, sometimes I think, oh, The Nation, you know, in-group, left-wing, blah, 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 blah. But the fact of the matter is, every now and then, just like Harper's, bam, great piece. Blood is Thicker Than Blackwater by Jeremy Scahill. Scahill? Scahill.
Looks good to me.
Ah, why not? It's from the May 8th issue. You can get it online at thenation.com. Okay, this article talks about Blackwater, talks about why those four guys got killed and then strung up, and what they were doing, and what Blackwater's doing.
Yeah, we better tell people what Blackwater is.
Oh, yeah. Blackwater is a private army. Folks, there are several of these that do the dirty work for the real army of the United States. They are usually people who are recruited out of, you know, retirement out of the Navy SEALs and Army Rangers and stuff like that. And they go to work for Blackwater, some of them because they're patriots, others of them because they're patriots, and they can make a lot more money working for Blackwater, I mean, gazillion more money than they can in the armed forces of the United States. And then there's some of them who are simply good old-fashioned murderous soldiers of fortune.
And it was an incident with some Blackwater employees that tripped off one of the most brutal incidents of the Iraq War, and it's no coincidence, one that has left the most lasting residue of hatred against us.
Absolutely. All right. Here's what happened. The Blackwater people, first of all, the recruitment process persuades them that they are patriots, that are going to be well paid for their patriotism, that they're going to be guarding American troop convoys, that they're going to be protecting American soldiers, that they're going to be essentially performing strategic work. And they're going to be in teams of four. They're going to have a rear gunner. They're going to have a unit that's covering every direction, in other words, on their armored, allegedly, vehicles. And everything's going to be cool. I mean, as cool as you can make it in the middle of a war. So they go out, and what do they discover? First of all, they discover that their services have been twice sold, to opportunistic companies, shall we tell them, connected to...
Go ahead.
Oh, man. Connected to the big boys of, what is it, KK and what are they, what do you call it?
KBR. Kellogg Brown and Root. A subsidiary of Halliburton.
Halliburton!
Whose former CEO is?
Is Dick Cheney.
Right.
Doc, it's Dick Cheney.
Who's still receiving...
Money.
Deferred compensation.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so there they are. They're cruising down the road. They don't have satellite positioning equipment. They don't have a map. They don't have a current map of the city. And what happens to them? They get cut off, they get isolated, they get killed, they get strung up on a bridge, and it becomes great propaganda for the United States.
They get brutally killed.
Brutally.
Yeah, torn to pieces by a mob, their bodies burned and hacked to pieces, and suspended from a bridge. People remember this. If you cast your mind back, you remember this.
And this becomes a great propaganda coup for the United States at the expense of these four Americans.
And in retaliation... We launched the now infamous siege of Fallujah.
And it was Fallujah, and we destroyed the city as much as we could.
Yeah, and used white phosphorus warheads.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if people understand white phosphorus. They need to understand this. White phosphorus has the quality of, if you get a piece of it on your skin, it just keeps burning. And it burns in and in and in and in and in and to and beyond the bone. White phosphorus is one of the most flammable and most deadly substances and most painful substances ever used in war. Very popular with the Nazis, by the way.
Yeah.
And, of course, the Americans. We used it in Vietnam. We are using it now to help our allies in Iraq.
And well, it's a chemical weapon.
Chemical
weapon. That's what it is.
It's a chemical weapon.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Chemical weapon?
It's a chemical weapon.
Wait a minute. Chemical weapon? Aren't we fighting against chemical weapons that Saddam had?
No, we didn't do that.
They didn't do there that? Weren't any.
There weren't any chemicals?
Didn't you hear that? There weren't any.
There weren't any chemical weapons?
No.
You mean we went to war for a lie?
Don't worry, weren't no nuclear weapons, neither.
No nuclear weapons?
No.
Well, how about germs? Were there germs?
No, no germs.
No germs? Wait a minute, we went to war, there was no germs, no chemical weapons, no nuclear weapons?
No.
So it was all a lie?
Yeah.
A lie?
No, not just one lie.
Many lies. Many lies. Yeah. But the American people are not upset because they are really more engaged in Pac-Man or whatever they... No, see, I'm so old. Yeah. Nor engaged in forest-fighting, sexy girl, car-driving, killer video game.
Yeah.
What's it called? Forest-fighting, killer video game.
I don't know.
Okay. See, I don't play video games. That's why I'm upset. If I would just watch video games and... develop my hand-eye coordination to the level where I could kill opponents mercilessly, I'd be all right.
Yep. There's a subtext here to this whole Blackwater thing that I find particularly disturbing. By and large, the ex-military people who are hired by Blackwater in Iraq to provide security for American diplomats, for their staff, and this has to be said, too, for American business people, were by and large paid many, many times more than American soldiers there doing essentially the same job. In some cases, these guys are making six figures. They are mercenaries, plain and simple. And this is breeding resentment amongst rank-and-file soldiers wearing the uniform of the United States stationed in Iraq, who are now, I guess, in increasing numbers, wondering what the hell they're doing there in the first place. Meanwhile, these guys are making all kinds of money doing the same job. And that their deaths, albeit gruesome deaths, are used to justify an America propaganda and military offensive against an Iraqi city. And I'm sure a lot of these soldiers are wondering, well, you know, why are our deaths not greeted with the same sort of intensity, the same sort of response?
Well, it is interesting. And it's also interesting that the central character in the story in The Nation, a guy named Halvinston, was actually a Navy SEAL and actually kind of a semi-star in various roles, in minor roles in Hollywood. And he was, I think, as portrayed here, an authentic patriot. And what he ended up doing was believing he was going to protect Bremer and those guys. And what he ended up doing, essentially, because his services and Blackwater services were twice sold to a Kuwait business called Regency Hotel and Hospital Company, a security contract from Eurest Support Services, that's ESS. They were guarding convoys. Here's how strategic they were: transporting kitchen equipment for the U.S. military. So he died going to move pots and pans.
Well, yeah, man. You can't rinse off your pans properly.
Excuse me, your pans, yes.
Yeah, how are you going to be a profitable exploiter?
So the guy died to pick up some tin.
Yeah.
Essentially. Well, now, you know, the whole thing is so stinking. I mean, there's the aspect you bring up, which is that people are being paid to be soldiers and to do the dirty work of soldiering as private armies, therefore presumably not responsible for the rules of engagement.
No, not at all responsible for the rules of engagement.
Okay, so we have murderers and soldiers of fortune and idealists who also are murderers with great training from the U.S. government, SEALs and so forth, doing the hard killing and getting killed, and then they become heroes in the American mind when they get slaughtered in a horrible way. And this further pushes the craziness.
This begs a number of larger questions. This
such
use
as?
Of mercenaries. Well, such as... one of the biggest problems we faced in, quote-unquote, winning this war in Iraq, we really haven't been told what that would mean or what that would look like, but is we don't have enough soldiers. Why don't we have enough soldiers? Because we've had an all-volunteer army since the draft was called off in the mid-70s, and the government has taken a great deal of pride in that. The problem is it's hard to get people to volunteer when they know they're going to get their ass shot off in the desert. So what do we do to fill in the gaps? We hire these ex-soldiers, not only from the United States, but from all over the world, to serve as this private mercenary army. And this isn't the first time. These people are working with American soldiers in South America, defending American oil infrastructure there, assisting the government of Colombia in its longstanding battle with FARC revolutionaries there.
Yeah, the so-called drug war.
Yeah, the so-called drug war. So what does this mean, then? If we don't have an army big enough to actually fight the wars as this country wants to fight, apparently, we've already been shown, they will pay other people a lot more to do it. And one of the justifications for sidestepping the Geneva Conventions in the treatment of prisoners that we happen to run into in this global war on terror has been that they are not standard combatants. They're not soldiers of a national army. Thus, they are not subject to the protections of the Geneva Conventions. But the flip side of that is, if we're hiring a bunch of people who themselves are not wearing the uniform of the United States, then we can give them more or less free rein to behave as they would, because they also are not subject to either the strictures or the protections of the Geneva Convention.
It is so nasty.
It is
so
nasty.
Stupid, and so disturbing that the American people are not, at this point, angry enough. You know what's going to cause the downfall of the Republicans? The price of gasoline. The profit-taking of the gas industry. Now, I happen to believe the price of gasoline should be around $5 a gallon, but I don't think there should be a profit going to the oil companies that's excessive. I think the great bulk of that should go into taxation that essentially turns around health care, education, and alternative energy.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I don't mind $5 gas if it's not going into the pockets of some Exxon Mobil exec or Standard Oil creepoid.
Yeah, I agree. I've received a bunch of emails lately talking about various attempts to organize to boycott particular oil companies or
You can't if you have a whole infrastructure of a society that's been created around dependence on gasoline, dependence on the single-family car, dependence on the truck.
I agree. Normally, I'm all for consumer advocacy and consumer action like that. I'm all for boycotts if it accomplishes an end. But in this case, the boycott is working in the wrong direction.
Yeah, they're all bad.
Let those gas prices climb, man.
Yeah, they're all bad. The part that people need to focus on and where the action needs to come is ripping the emperor's clothes off of this oligarchy that is now running this country and the people who are profiting so much from it.
Yeah.
You know, these kiss-kiss nasty guys.
I've even... kiss-kiss nasty guys.
That's pretty
that's
good.
That's the guy painting with a broad brush.
Well, what I want to do is...
sure, one time or another, you've been a kiss-kiss nasty guy, Joe.
No. One time or another, I've been a swell fella. But the point is that I want to demystify the macho nonsense of these people. You know, Cheney going out. I want to get the whole cultural context clear. Here's what they really are. They're people who go hunting by taking tame birds, shaking them up, turning them upside down, and letting them loose, and then blowing their heads off.
And their friends' heads off.
I mean, who are these creeps? How can they be running a country as big as this one? How did this happen?
Well, that's a long story.
We're not
too much
to
talk about today.
We are. I don't want to forget. There's a rally about the Darfur situation, much ignored in America. You know,
Yeah, another genocide.
Another genocide.
Do we get oil from there?
Well, there is oil in the next door nation.
Oh, we got to get involved.
Yeah. But there is a rally about the horrors of Darfur that's going to take place this Sunday, 1:30 to about 3:00 at Pioneer Courthouse Square. I hope there's a big crowd for that. I hope people care enough about these people, you know, because this is the Americans we're so concerned about we're freedom building. Well, man, look at Darfur.
This is another argument for the standing blue-helmeted UN Army I've mentioned before.
I think we need the standing.
An international peacekeeping.
Standing
force.
Or even sitting blue-helmeted
sitting.
Army.
Yeah, they can sit
around.
When they're not standing.
They can do that.
Yeah, I think there's a big case to be made for that. But again, that's a story for another
Blue day. Water.
Blue water.
Okay, so Blackwater essentially is a private army. And by the way, it was in New Orleans, too.
Yes.
I mean, these guys are ruthless guys who cruise around and shoot people at the direction of sort of the United States. They don't have the rules of combat that conventional armies, the Geneva Accord, none of that protection, nor do they have to abide by those rules. Four guys get murderously killed because people are outraged in Fallujah. They're strung up, and that becomes the excuse for us to destroy Fallujah.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's winning hearts and minds.
That's winning hearts and minds.
Well, what's left of the hearts.
Yeah, the liquefied hearts and minds.
Oh, man, this is so bad. And then phosphorus. And why aren't people more offended?
Because I think, by and large, people aren't in the know. But that's been changing.
It's been changing.
You know that Fox News ran a poll on the president's approval last week?
No.
You know what it came up?
30%.
33%.
Oh, well, see,
on
I was
Fox. On Fox.
And they acknowledged that.
Yes, they did.
Wow.
And these guys are in trouble. And they are going through a bunch of dog and pony shows right now to try and convince the rest of us they're not in trouble.
But what happens if this little government that they put together in Iraq sort of functions enough so that they can sort of claim victory?
It's not going to. Any government that comes to power in Iraq under the umbrella of a U.S. occupation is not going to be perceived as legitimate.
I think you're right.
These attacks are going to continue until we're gone. End of story.
But
we have now become the problem.
Maybe this government will have the courage to tell us to go away.
Perhaps they will, but I don't think we – why would we build permanent bases if we have any plans of going away?
Have you seen the
we
new permanent –
no plans of going away.
Have you seen the new supposedly secret permanent base that we're building in the green zone of the capital of Baghdad?
Isn't that the safe part of town? Why do we need a double secret
we're building a
permanent
super permanent bases.
No,
we're building,
I didn't hear about that.
Oh, yeah, and we're building permanent air bases all over Iraq, too. It's almost as if we intend to stay forever.
We do intend to stay forever. We never had any intention of leaving.
No. You think?
No.
It's so outrageous. It's so outrageous. So the article you folks need to get, go on your computers or buy The Nation on May 8th, but go on your computers right now and go to thenation.com, Blood is Thicker Than Water by Scahill, S-C-A-H-I-L-L. It's really a good article, well worth reading. And by the way, it broke into the news. I mean, Amy Goodman, for example, did it last week. We're not so ahead of the curve here because we're only once a week.
That's right.
We fall behind. What else you got?
I got a
lot.
Cheer
me up.
Okay. We're going to try and lay down a little narrative thread here that will hopefully dovetail with what Greg Palast has to say with us today. Okay. There's a number of things going on in Washington right now that have piqued my interest, believe it or not.
Something in Washington piquing your interest?
Yeah. There's a new White House chief of staff.
Oh, yeah.
Andrew Card is out. This guy Joshua Bolton is in.
Bolton, tough, mean, hard.
Yeah. Anyway, this is supposed to provide the illusion that a staff shakeup at the White House will indicate a new direction and a new leaf that has been.
Yeah, the whole problem is personnel. It's not policy.
Right. Of course.
Yeah.
So we've seen the press secretary Scott McClellan resign. However, nobody was waiting in the wings to take his place. The leading candidate at this point is Fox News radio and TV commentator Tony Snow.
Well, we knew Tony Snow was an unbiased guy.
Right. Fair and balanced.
Fair and balanced journalism.
So
yeah.
He's going to be the spokes puppet for the White House.
What chutzpah?
Yeah.
I like the term spokes puppet.
Spokes puppet. Now, the most significant thing.
Punching bag. Yeah.
Spokes model, something.
Yeah.
Karl Rove. We know who Karl Rove is.
Karl Rove.
Yeah, Bush's brain, the turd blossom, et cetera, et cetera. The mastermind of Bush's political successes since he began having political successes.
Yes.
Which essentially was the first time he ran for governor in Texas because he lost.
And lost a fortune in the oil business and didn't do too well in the baseball business either.
No, he didn't. No,
not a successful guy.
No. Karl Rove, his job first and foremost has been politics in the White House. Even when he was put to work on policy, he never stopped being political.
Right. In fact, I would say all policy, aside from helping the oil companies and advancing this United States takes over the world thing, all policy and destroying the federal government on the local level, helping people. All policy is basically fueled by some kind of PR concern.
Yeah, it is.
Outside of that.
It is. It's either damage control or misdirection.
Right.
Yeah.
Pay no attention to the little guy behind the curtain.
Right. Pay no attention to the drowning, displaced black people. Things are going great in New Orleans.
Yeah,
they just had an election.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
But they wouldn't let the New Orleans people who live in Texas vote.
No, they would not.
But they would let Iraqis living in the United States vote in the Iraqi election.
They did. They would let Mexicans living in the United States vote in the Mexican election.
Well, sure.
But not displaced black people from New Orleans.
No.
But so this is what Karl Rove does.
Yes.
All right. Now, Karl Rove has been – his policy portfolio has been taken away. He's been put full-time in charge of politics.
Well, we are told his policy portfolio has been taken away.
Right. Now, there's been much speculation as to why this has happened.
Wait. Go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry. How rude.
People have suggested that this has happened because there's an indictment looming for him in the Valerie Plame affair.
Ooh, indictment.
But E.J. Dionne last Friday in the Washington Post made what I think is the telling point on this.
Yeah.
He's been put in charge of full-time in charge of politics because the entire policy objective of the White House from here until November, and by extension, the entire policy objective of the Republican Party is to maintain control of both houses of Congress.
But they have the Diebold machines.
The Diebold machines, yes, are the wild card in this whole situation. But this is what they fear more than everything. They fear a Congress with subpoena power and people willing to use it, because they fear investigations of everything.
You mean like Watergate?
Everything.
Whoa.
Yeah, like Watergate. Well, we're going to get to that a little bit later. But that is first and foremost what's on their minds right now. That's why Rove is full-time in charge of politics. That's why you can expect every progressive candidate in every district in this country who's opposing a Republican incumbent, you can expect them to be swift voted sometime in the near future.
Right, swift voting.
Swift voting.
Yes. And here, I have a real question about this. I don't understand. Can Karl Rove function as essentially a mercenary for the Republican Party and still be paid with federal tax dollars?
Yes, he can.
I don't get that. Shouldn't he have to work for the Republican National Committee or something?
No. Those lines have been blurred by this administration many times.
So we should just forget about that.
Uniformed military personnel have been, until quite recently, appearing at Republican campaign events around the country.
Right. Right. So essentially they are, it's kind of like the Nazis. That is, the state and the party are one.
Yes, exactly. Taxpayer dollars have been funding President Bush's public appearances, at which you can't visit, you can't be in the audience, unless you take a loyalty oath to the president.
Yes.
Now, so that, you know, that gray area has been made even grayer by these folks. And the hand of Rove is in all of that. So what, everything they do from here to November, you need to ask yourself, when you observe it, how does this pertain to retaining control of both houses of Congress? Because a Congress headed by the opposition party with the cojones to use subpoena power is the one thing that this administration cannot abide and cannot withstand. Nothing that they have done since September 11th would stand up in the light of a concerted congressional investigation.
You know, this
nothing.
All of this is such a level of corruption beyond anything in the past, I think. Gorbadal was talking a little bit about this at the Wordstock, and he was very depressed, obviously. I mean, he's 80 years old. He's, he's a lively and witty man, but he's very depressed about the situation. Here's a guy who really loves this country, you know, spent a lot of time writing history of it and so on, trying to demystify it and understand it and praise it, but also point out its weaknesses. And he's very, very sad. But I something hit me. Now, maybe there's lots of articles out there about this, and I don't want conspiracy buff calls. I don't. I'm tired of it. But I have to say, this caught my attention. Do you remember the weapons-grade anthrax?
Yes.
Do you remember that it was traced to Fort Detrick?
I don't recall.
Yeah, it's a secure government facility where we supposedly got rid of the stuff, but we still have it. Okay? We do have that kind of weapon of mass destruction still. But the point is that it showed up in the Senate.
It showed up in the Democratic Senate office.
Yes.
Of two prominent senators who at the time were questioning the passage of the Patriot Act.
Exactly. And what happened to their votes? They changed their votes. Now, I don't want
to... Because they were scared for their lives.
I don't want to suggest that this might have been a plot, but it was targeted to the two guys who were most significant in opposing the Patriot Act.
Daschle and... I can't remember the other guy's name.
Leahy.
Leahy.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We're getting old, man.
We are getting old.
Leahy and Daschle suddenly find their offices poisoned. Suddenly they turn white with terror, and suddenly they're willing to change their votes. Now, I don't think that's a coincidence. Weapons grade from the U.S. government. Never figured out how it got there.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah, I remember at the time...
it wasn't Al-Qaeda.
No, reading news reports that, of course, fingers were pointed at Saddam Hussein. Saying Iraq lacked the facilities to mill anthrax as finally as this anthrax had been milled.
Yeah, no, it was weapons grade from the United States government out of Fort Detrick. And who has access to that?
The White House. 231-8187 is the number to call. We're going to have Greg Palast on momentarily, yours and my favorite expatriate journalist. So give us a call right now if you want to talk about Blackwater.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go to our next caller. It is not. I'm misreading the signals. Totally misread. Okay. All right. A couple of things I want to talk about that relate to the business of the show. I think it would be good if for a while we had, unless it's information about an event, we had only calls from new folks. There's so many people that listen to this show that I run into that tell me they can't get in. That they can't get in, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that would be nice, but I think you're dreaming.
Think I'm dreaming?
Yeah, I don't think our regulars are going to stop calling just because we asked them to.
Well, okay, let's take our next call. I bet it's a regular.
Annalisa,
it's a regular.
Good morning.
Annalisa. Hi, regular.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I don't have much time, but I would like to suggest to read a book by Inga Musio. She's a local writer.
Uh-huh.
And the book is called An Autobiography of a Blue-Eyed Devil, My Life and Times in a Racist Imperialist Society.
Mm.
It's an excellent book to read.
Whoa. Self-excoriation?
Pardon?
You know, putting themself, herself down? Himself down?
Is
it her or she, he or she?
A her.
Okay, putting herself down. Or is she being funny? Is she just being funny? She's just being funny.
It's an excellent book.
I don't have blue eyes.
Thank you.
So what do I know?
All right. Thanks
for the suggestion.
Thanks, Annalisa.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I'm all for new callers.
See, here's what's so weird. But here's, never mind that. But here's what's so weird. This country is divided into three camps. The know-nothing, care-nothing, watch TV, worry about their finances, get angry about the oil price, gas price crowd, which is the majority of the American people. The right-wing fanatical believe the devil's alive and active and don't care about the teachings of Jesus but want to see gays punished crowd, you know, the supporters of this current administration. Mm-hmm. The outraged liberals, still naive, and then the even more outraged lefties who are also, well, they catch on quicker.
That was four camps.
Yeah. So is that four camps?
Yeah.
I can't count.
I bet there's more.
I bet there's more camps.
We'll go with that for now.
And then there's the weird conspiracy people. That's the fifth camp.
Yeah.
All right. So all of that is going on. But the main thing that's going on is people don't pay attention. They don't care. They're miseducated in their schools or uneducated in their schools. They're misinformed by the mass media. They're left in a place, and they don't read much, you know. They're left in a place of total confusion, dismay, alienation, and doubt, in which they are so cynical, it's been so successfully done to them by the right, that they have no faith in government whatsoever, therefore they make no demands of it, therefore when it messes them over, they just shrug their shoulders and bend their heads and complain about the price of the gasoline. That's what's going on in America today. And that's the end of the Republic.
Oh, come on now.
Oh, come on now. Tell me I'm not right.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Oh,
I just wanted to mean the end of the Republic. Not quite ready for that.
You're not ready for the end of the Republic?
No, nobody checked with me.
What do you... with who? You?
With
you? Yeah, well... Okay.
KBOO 90.7 FM. That's, you know, this station that you're hearing my voice on right now.
Yes, and my voice too.
231-8187 is the number to call. In just a moment, we're going to have Greg Palast on the phone. My name's Abe Proctor. That's Joe Uris.
I'm Joe Uris. He's Abe Proctor.
I'm Abe Proctor. That's Joe Uris.
Yeah,
you're listening to Talk Radio on KBOO. So far this morning, we've been talking about Blackwater, the mercenary security company being contracted to provide security services to diplomats, to business people.
And to pots and pans.
And to pots in
pots and pans. We protect our pots and pans, lest they fall into the hands of the deadly enemies.
That's right. We've also been talking about the recent shakeup in the White House. Well, it's allegedly a shakeup.
You know, not a shakeup. It's
Cheney,
not even
Rumsfeld,
a come on, they're not even rattling the cage.
Are still there, so no,
oh,
it's not
they
really
just
a shakeup.
They changed the. It's like the. It's like musical chairs without taking away a chair.
Right. So we've also been talking about the fact that what the Republicans fear the most right now is the losing control of one or both houses of Congress. So all you Naderites and Greens out there, I want you to suck it up and vote for Democrat this fall.
Well, I don't know. I don't even worry about that. I think here's what I worry about. And I really worry about this. I believe the elections are so fixed. In fact, Greg Palast, who we're going to be talking to momentarily, pointed out it was the guy who got the data that proved that the Florida election in 2000 was rigged.
Yep, he did.
Is Greg with us?
Nope.
He's coming on. He's rushing to the phone. He's buttoning his pants. He's heading our way. He's in the East Coast, I think.
Is he in the country?
No, like
he's not still in Britain.
He's good.
That'd be really cool if he called us from Britain.
Why would that be cool?
Well, because you know, it's another country and all.
Okay, so we got a lot to talk about, and I got to tell you, Greg Palast, who you all probably know, has his next book, Armed Madhouse. I think it might be about this country. Will be in Portland for a benefit on Monday, June 5th. And maybe we'll get him on more than once because I really like the guy. I've talked with him a bunch. I even broke bread with him once at Higgins, la-di-da. Mm. And, you know, he's a cool guy. Had a drink and stuff. You know.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, he... All right. Here he is.
Hey,
Welcome, Mr. Palast. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, Joe.
How
are you, man?
What can I tell you? Fifth year of the Bush regime.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
I'm going gray by the day.
Okay, yeah.
And he's really young and has red hair and, he's really
pretty.
Can
I come out from under the desk yet? It's like duck and cover here for 5 years. So what's up?
Well, we have some questions for you.
Okay.
You no doubt saw the, and you probably knew about it even before this, you saw the Blackwater piece in The Nation.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to get your take on these, just to start our conversation, I wanted to get your take on these private armies and all of this stuff.
Well, I mean, this is just part of a trend of privatizing everything that isn't nailed down in the United States. So they're privatized. You just look at this as everything from privatizing your Social Security, privatizing your war. The idea is to sell off everything that doesn't move, including the policies and all the. And in fact, one of the things in my new book, An Armed Madhouse, that will be coming out soon, is, for example, privatization of the hurricane emergency planning. I mean, people don't realize, I think most people don't know that, before Hurricane Katrina hit, the Bush boys outsourced and privatized the planning for the evacuation of New Orleans in case of a hurricane, and we saw what happened.
I didn't know that. I actually didn't know that.
There you go. Because I'll tell you something, Abe, you're not supposed to know it. That's why I'm an investigative reporter. If I read the crap in the New York Times, I wouldn't be doing this job. I mean, that's the problem. They don't want you to know this stuff. That's why you have to read about Blackwater and the Nation or the privatization of hurricane preparedness. And by the way, when they say privatize it, say, well, the New York Times, in fact, even ran an editorial saying, we ought to turn over hurricane preparations to Walmart. They know how to get things done. Well, they did turn it over to this private operators whose experience in hurricane planning was giving donations to several dozen Republicans. Zero planning. In fact, these guys lied. They said that they had hired Clinton's old hurricane expert, a very well-known expert in the field, and that he was on their team. It was a complete, utter, bogus, fraud,
lie.
Basically, played on the government. And that's how you ended up with dead people floating in the streets of New Orleans. This is no joke. They are privatizing. See, because don't look at it just Blackwater privatizing the war in Iraq or anywhere else. It is privatizing the class war.
Wow. And that would include, of course, privatizing the water?
Yes, and let's get into water. Well, you saw what happened in Portland with Enron. I mean, the people ought to be ashamed of themselves for not turning that back into a public entity.
I have to agree there.
You've got private electricity sold out to marauders when we know darn well that the public does this stuff better. It goes from water, electricity. We have America has the cheapest, cleanest water in the world because for the most part it is not privatized. I mean, you go anywhere else on the planet like Britain, they privatized their water system and people, they had what's called, hose limits where you're not allowed to water your lawn, for parts of the year because, the private water companies decided that it's cheaper to let the water leak in the ground and not fix the pipes. So, war is just the ugliest aspect of it because what they want to do is privatize the coffins. They don't, when you kill off the mercenaries, and when private armies are mercenaries, when you kill off the mercenaries, they don't count in the body count.
Ah.
Mm.
Think about that.
And privatization is pretty much the MO of the World Bank and the IMF whenever they go in to help bail out a struggling national economy, right?
They encourage my books, eh?
Right. They encourage accepting loans from the private sector and also selling off infrastructure.
Well, in fact, let me give you an example from Armed Madhouse. It sounds like I'm doing a sales pitch here, and you can get it on Amazon.com. Don't worry about it. I'm very concerned about what's happened. Wolfowitz, after doing such a wonderful job in Iraq, Paul Wolfowitz is now president of the World Bank, and one of people forget about that. Like, he kind of, like, disappeared. Well, he kind of took over the globe. He's president of the World Bank, and one of his first acts in office, and by the way, if you just tuned in, this is Greg Palast talking in this conspiratorial voice. one of his first acts in office, Wolfowitz, was to cut off capital to the nation of Ecuador, because Ecuador refused to sell off all of its state oil assets. Now, you have to understand, Ecuador used to be a member of OPEC. It has a fair amount of oil. And the new president of Ecuador, a guy named, he has the same name as me, Palacio, I met with him just the week after he took office.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, very conservative guy. He was a cardiologist in the United States and then went down to Ecuador to become president.
But he has heart.
And yeah, exactly. And you know, he said, "Look, in fact, he'd be a Republican in the U.S. Except he said, "Look, we got this oil, and yet we've got very ill people here. We need $5 million to run a vaccine program for kids. We have basically no educational system. We need a few bucks. So what I want to do is keep some of the oil money here for health and education." And Wolfowitz said, "The hell you will! You're going to privatize your water system. You're going to privatize your electric system. You're going to privatize your oil companies, and if you don't, we're cutting you off." So they basically try to cut off the windpipe of the nation of Ecuador until they privatize their oil systems, which would leave them bereft of their oil. So what happened was is that they were saved, by the way,
mm-hmm.
After they were tied to the railroad tracks by Paul Wolfowitz and the World Bank, is that the president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, flew in, wrote a check for $250 million and brought in actually a tanker full of oil as well and gasoline for Ecuador. And by the way, Chavez, who I just met with a couple weeks ago, who says he wants to eliminate the IMF and the World Bank and create instead an International Humanitarian Fund, or IHF, what I call the International Hugo Fund, because he's given out all the money. You know, what they're doing is, in fact, getting around this push to privatization. So he is the Mr. Anti-privatization.
He's a dangerous socialist.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is he's really not a socialist or a Marxist. He's no real Che Guevara. I know the guy pretty well. Like I said, I just was with him a couple weeks ago. In fact, if you want to catch the interview of me with him, go to gregpalace.com and check out my BBC television report with Chavez. He's actually kind of in the old liberal mode. I mean, I think John Kennedy would have liked him, Alliance for Progress. Actually, he got along very well with Bill Clinton, which probably I'm sure Bush will never forgive. The guy just believes that, that believe it or not, the rich are not born to inherit the earth, that the oil money in Ecuador, in Argentina, in Venezuela, and Brazil ought to go to the Argentines, the Brazilians, and the Ecuadorians, and not be just kind of sucked up by big oil and the proceeds sent to New York banks. So what he said is, he's refusing all these demands for privatization. He gave money to Ecuador so they wouldn't have to privatize everything that wasn't nailed down or was. He gave $2 billion to Argentina so they could also end the demands for privatization imposed by the World Bank. I mean, one of the things that the World Bank required Argentina to do, as you know, was to sell off the Buenos Aires Water Company to Enron. Which then when they went bankrupt, they siphoned out all the money, and now the Argentina's left with a busted, bankrupt, broken water system. So, like I say, you can't just take the Blackwater example by itself. It is part of an entire process of privatizing the planet. And when they say private, they mean, there's a small group of people who keep it very private. A few members of the club are allowed in.
And here domestically, it's about undoing the New Deal, even privatizing our national retirement system.
Indeed. Actually, you have read my book. I haven't sent you a
copy.
No.
See, great minds work the same time.
It has not been released yet. It doesn't come out until June 6th. You guys got some type of illegal advance copy?
We're prescient.
Now we just pay attention.
By the way, I will be out to support KBOO and release the book on June 5th. I'm releasing the book in Portland, of all places.
All right.
Nationwide. And
are you going to be at Powell's?
Great place. What?
Are you going to be at Powell's?
Well, actually, Powell's will be there with KBOO because we won't be able to fit. The last time I was in Portland, we had about 1,200 people, so we can't all stuff into Powell's without the roof collapsing. So we will be, I don't know where the event is. Go to gregpalace.com.
Well, we'll be promoting the hell out of you in the near future.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure KBOO will have it. But anyway, the important thing is you say when they're taking apart the New Deal. just so people understand a little history. Hello, history?
Yeah.
Remember
Hello.
That? I mean, you're not supposed to know about that in America. You know, nothing happened since the last episode of Friends, right? But
That's
actually,
right.
There was a world before this. The New Deal did not begin with Franklin Roosevelt. The New Deal began in 1928 when the levees of New Orleans collapsed and the city was drowned. When New Orleans was flooded and destroyed in 1928, up to that point, the ruling economic theories were that, no budget deficits, let the rich rule, and they'll take care of us, no unions, et cetera, no government help. When the levees burst, a guy rose above the floodwaters named Huey Long and said, enough is enough. America's a rich country. Let's share the wealth. Old people should have pensions. Veterans should have pensions. People should have health care. Everyone should have a job. It's the government job to protect people from floods, to build the bridges, to build the levees, to build the roads, and put people to work. And that was the beginning. He called it the Share the Wealth campaign, Huey mm-hmm. Long, and Franklin Roosevelt adopted it, and it became the New Deal. And now they're trying, like you say, they're trying to take that New Deal away, and that's everything from privatizing Social Security. I mean, one of the things that Huey Long and Roosevelt created was the 40-hour work week. And now Bush very quietly has changed the law, so it's very difficult to legally demand overtime. I mean, it's just little sneaky, little nasty, little evil-minded stuff that they're up to.
It's really hard to keep track of the number of initiatives, as you characterize them, sneaky little initiatives.
Actually, I have 290.
290?
But go ahead.
I'm impressed, Greg. That is a horrendous number. Has there ever been an administration in American history that has rolled back so much so well?
No, even Reagan, who tried it, okay, couldn't do it because he had a Democratic Congress. And also Reagan, believe it or not, despite that crooked little grin that evilly and secretly attacked Nicaragua.
Right.
He actually did really believe in this idea of a safety net. He was a poor kid who relied on student loans and relied on government education and relied on the GI Bill. And so he actually believed that and he even believed, for example, in food stamps, which, Bill Clinton signed away. No one has come close to what these guys are up to because they do it quietly and silently. They've got us so distracted with the war in Iraq, which I call, it's the weapon of mass distraction over there. Yes, it's evil, but what's happening is that's becoming a cover for every other evil because they've got us so distracted with their the horror show going on there, which, we can't ignore. But it's like a magician who is, who's waving a dead chicken head in front of us. It's pretty distracting, so you don't see his Confederates are picking your pocket.
I think what you said earlier about history is really the key to all of this. If you have any sort of conception of the sweep of history, say from the beginning of the New Deal on, you realize that the greatest growth of the middle class in human history occurred in this country, and it happened when the demand side of the economy was stimulated. It happened when personal and corporate income tax rates were in the 80% and 90% range, and we were able to rebuild our conquered enemies in Europe and Japan. We were able to build an interstate highway system, and we were able to build a university system that was the envy of the world, and we were able to educate all those soldiers who fought fascism in the Second World War. And somehow...
Wait a minute. It sounds like... Have you had this speech approved by the terrorism czar? I suspect not, buddy.
No.
I don't even know if... under Patriot Act 3, you won't even be able to make these statements. In fact, your brain will be wiped clean of what happened in the New Deal.
That's why I'm doing it now.
In fact, actually, this is very important. It's one of the things that, I'm looking at this issue of class war. And in fact, looking at what Chavez has done in Venezuela, which they don't want you to do. They want to tell you he's a dictator and all this baloney.
Talks too long.
Well, yeah, he does talk.
Talks too long.
But, okay, I'll grant that. I actually
talks too
during
long.
His last speech, he does gas on a bit. Well, so do I.
Talks
but,
too long.
But one of the things he's done is that the Venezuelan economy grew by 9% last year. I mean, faster than China, 14% the year before. And the reason is he's had controls on capital where it can't leave the country. He's raised the taxes on the rich, so they've got to actually invest or get taxed. And, you know, he has guaranteed education, jobs, health care, and food to the people, and that's created what you call demand-side push. In other words, when you give money to people, they spend it,
yes.
The economy grows. If you take away people's overtime, if you cut Social Security, if you cut pensions, like right now the Delphi auto workers are losing all their pensions. These are the General Motors workers who've been cut loose to drown by General Motors. You know what? That, you know, we're not helped by that.
Yeah.
That means that those people are not spending to keep this economy alive. Detroit's being wiped out. And by the way, they love it. There is nothing better. This administration knows that over $45 a barrel for oil, the airline industry is doomed. And they love it because the airline industry and the auto industry in America are the last centers of democratic unionism in this country. And if they can get those, there is nothing between them and the horizon of gold. So you have to understand that what's going on now is a deliberate attempt to keep high oil prices high. Those who believe we went into Iraq to get cheap oil really don't understand what happened in Iraq. There has been no mistakes made. These guys have not goofed up. Everything is running to plan. And that is what is frightening, Abe.
Mission accomplished.
You know,
mission accomplished.
This is Joe. You know, I have a couple of things I want to bring up, and actually a couple of questions for you. The first real serious question I have is, hey, can they get away with this?
Can they get away with this?
Well, I mean, you know, doesn't it collapse? Doesn't it collapse of its own absurd contradictions?
I wish that that were true. See, because what's happened is that they are sucking the life force out of the American body politic. See, when the levees busted in New Orleans in 1928, people got really angry, and they said, we're not going to put up with this. And so they elected Huey Long, governor, who really was a redistributionist socialist revolutionary.
Uh-huh.
They elected him governor. He created the New Deal. Roosevelt picked it up, and, you know, basically they wiped out the entire Republican Congress. And you have to understand, when Roosevelt came in, there were no Republicans left in America, basically, after that. I mean, they were just cleaned out. This was after complete Republican control because people got angry and felt they could do something about it. What they're trying to do is take away the idea that you can do anything about it. So you've got this blabocracy in the mainstream media, which keeps you distracted with complete, utter, useless baloney. You know, they lie to you. I mean, you have to understand, when the Downing Street, for example, the Downing Street memo, if you remember that,
sure.
which it was said that Bush was fixing the facts to the policy to get us into the war in Iraq. I remember when I brought that to the attention of the U.S. press, which had been completely comatose over this, the response in the New York Times was, well, this is not the Rosetta Stone. Who cares? So are they getting away with it? Yeah, because there is, except for independent radio like KABU, et cetera, and a few independent sources, people are not getting, one, the information, and two, they're being disempowered. We just don't have yet the Huey Longs. You don't have the strong Democratic Party, which is standing up and saying, this will not stand.
I'm glad you said that, because the Democrats haven't stood up and said anything. In fact, they act more like invertebrates than, you know, human beings.
Yes, well, I mean, you know, you've got it. That's why they're like jellyfish. It's hard to stand up if you don't have a spine.
Well, they don't have subpoena power, granted, but I think that's really what this administration is afraid of, a Congress with subpoena power and the stones to use it.
Well, exactly. And one of the things that's very, very important, I mean, like, I think that there's strong people like Howard Dean in the Democratic Party, but he's pushing on a string. I mean, you do have to understand, we had a candidate the Democrats had a candidate for president in the last election who said that the problem with Iraq is we didn't have enough troops there.
Yeah.
We weren't taking on the economic class warfare, which is going on here. I mean, and that's the big issue. We are not defending our rights to, to maintain our union jobs, which is very, very vital.
I think the big issue is that we have been propagandized as a nation over and over again to deny the nature of class and to deny the legitimacy of class interest and to create a mythological notion that we're all middle class, including the very rich and the very poor. And
well,
that
there's And no one pushed that idea harder than the Republican candidate in 2000, Al Gore. I know that he nominally registered himself as a Democrat, but he won the election. I mean, you do have to grant him that. But
well, you showed that. You proved
that.
Yeah,
but now Gore won the election, but he didn't deserve to. It's unfortunate there was no Democrat candidate, but this was the guy, if you remember, who stood up and debated Ross Perot over NAFTA. And Al Gore said that that if we open our borders and take on the Republican idea of free trade, free for all, for everyone, he specifically said that the industry that would really benefit would be auto parts workers in America. And now we have every single auto parts company in America is in bankruptcy from NAFTA. We went from a $5 billion trade surplus with Mexico to a $45 billion a year deficit with Mexico, and then they opened up China and gave China Clinton gave China most favored nation the trading status, and the result is that right now our trade deficit with China is bigger than our trade deficit with OPEC, and that's saying quite a lot. And, and that costs jobs, buddy. And it doesn't, by the way, help the Mexicans, because the Mexican incomes went down after NAFTA because Mexicans in Juarez at the Chrysler assembly plant in Juarez were competing against the Flint workers for the same job, so that you had the Flint workers and you had the Juarez workers fighting against each other, bidding each other's wages down to get the little dribs and drabs of work from the international corporation.
Well, at what point, and this is really, at what point, given the lack of information that working people in America have, at what point do they wake up? And if they wake up, do they simply jump patriot fascist, or do they recognize their commonality as a class and throw these SOBs out?
You're a very dangerous man. We're going to have a discussion with Mr. Negroponte about these lines.
I got a summer home in Canada.
What we need first is the information. I think one of the things is we have this sense that we're getting the shaftola, but we really have to know, shine a light down that shaft.
But look.
I mean, and that's very important. For example, when we talk about, for example, the theft of the elections, which is very important, they can't take away your Social Security unless they take away your vote first to protect yourself. They can't take away wipe away the city of New Orleans unless they eliminate voting for black people, which is what they're doing systematically. In the last election, you have to know how they are doing it so you can prevent it from being done. It's no use just kind of generally carping. We have to know the mechanisms of how their weapons work in this class war.
Greg, when you say we, all of us, probably most of our audience, certainly yourself, and I think Abe and I, understand all of what we're having. We're talking to the choir. The problem is that the vast number of American people are either indifferent or in total ignorance. We have a failed educational system in the context of class understanding. We have a total mythology in the context of nationalism. We are a people in ignorance, and we have grown up in a certain level of privilege, which is slowly being stripped away, and the blow of the being stripped away is softened by the credit system, which enslaves us as well. Now, how do we cut through to the American people? And when that happens, how do we make sure they understand what's real or instead of what's nationalist absurd?
Well, I think we have to, I don't agree that we have all the info out on the table. I think that most people really do not understand, what was behind the oil situation in Iraq, which was basically an attempt by big oil. This is James Baker, by the way, who's now being put again in charge of our Iraq policy, if you look at the papers. His little institute actually drafted up a plan for Iraq's oil, which basically said we got to make sure that Iraq stays a good member of OPEC so that prices stay high. We actually have the internal U.S. documents showing this stuff. I mean, what they're trying to do is keep the price of oil high. Now, why are they trying to keep the price of oil high? Why would Bush want to keep the price of oil high? I mean, the obvious thing is that he's from an oil family.
Mm-hmm.
His money, his family's millions come from Zapata oil. And Dick Cheney's out of the oil industry. Bush himself has owned a couple oil companies. But that's too simple. What's really going on is that the massive outflow to OPEC states results in a massive inflow of petrodollars from these states to fund our massive deficit. When you talk about indebtedness to the American people, this is why we are in debt to the Saudis. What's happening is that the reason why George Bush runs around in a golf cart with that dictator in a white robe, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, is not mm-hmm. because he wants to make sure that Saudi Arabia sells us their oil. I mean, there's only so much that King Abdullah's harem can pour on his belly. He's got to sell us his oil. The reason why Abdullah gets given the royal treatment for just basically a dictator in a robe is that he gives back almost all the money he collects back to New York banks, back to London banks, back to Swiss banks, where it is then funding the U.S. deficit. We have $2 trillion of U.S. Treasury bills and bonds held by foreigners who are keeping us alive, the Chinese, the Saudis, the Japanese. They're keeping the American economy alive, but we are now beholden to them. In fact, one of the reasons why they want to kill Hugo Chavez of Venezuela is that he's actually removed Venezuela's petrodollar reserves from the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank. And he says that that money has to stay in Latin America to build our continent. He says, I'm not trying to ruin the United States. He says, I'd rather cut the price of oil. But that doesn't help Bush to cut the price of oil. He wants the money out so he can borrow it back in.
So what you're suggesting essentially is, in essence, the United States becomes totally in hoc to these oil barons. Is that right?
That's right. And it has tremendously, so you say, so big deal. So, okay, so the Saudis and the Chinese hold U.S. Treasury bonds. The big deal is, babies, is two things. One, you have to keep the system rolling, you have to keep the price of oil high, and that means the end of American industry. Look at what's happening to airlines. Look at what's happening to auto. Look at what's happening to the plastics industry. I know it's not very glamorous, but look at what's happening to it. It's all going away.
Yeah, but
right?
But wait.
And then interest rates are rising to the point to keep so that the Japanese, Chinese, and Saudis will keep their money in U.S. Treasury bonds. We have to keep the interest rates high because despite the Koran's prohibition on collecting interest, the Saudis really want their pound of flesh, so we have to keep up the interest rates, and that is just absolutely murdering our manufacturing base.
But
we can't survive.
But what happens to the American working person?
Well, don't count on your pension. That's where we begin. But the question is, can we develop that sense of reasoned anger that developed in 1928 to 1932 when we changed the entire political landscape of America, when the average working person just said, hey, we don't have to stand here. We don't have to grab our ankles every time they come around to shaft us. We don't. And now how do we get that sense back of empowerment? And I begin with the idea that if we don't start with educating ourselves on what's going on, in fact, one of the things that they are trying very, very hard to do is making sure that our kids stay stupid. That's why we have Bush's No Child Behind Left program. In fact, I kind of end my book with No Child Behind Left because I think that's the core thing. See, they got to take away everything.
Well, they're also
and they got to take away your hope, and that means taking away your kids. And they got to keep you stupid because anyone with half a brain is not going to put up with this.
Well, they're also going to try to shut down easy access to the internet. They're going to try to create a hierarchical access to the internet. As you know, there's a bill, I think it's going before Congress today, very quietly, which would essentially allow the AT&Ts of this world to dominate the internet and to control levels of access based on what kind of money and the size of the outfit. So Google will.
You've got a problem with that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the Internet's been the one wild card in this whole situation. The free, unfettered transmission of ideas was perhaps the one thing that might help roll this whole tide back. And it's true even now. If the only honest reporting, or some of the only honest reporting, what you're doing in Britain and what some of the other British papers are doing is good. But here, you got to turn to the blogs, really,
well,
if you want to get a handle on it.
My stuff, in fact, when I put out the stuff on the Downing Street memo, it was dissed by the New York Times as coming from the blogs. Now, that didn't matter that I'm a reporter for BBC Television and the Guardian papers, which are very mainstream in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it came through the Internet. So they want to scare you. It comes through the Internet. In fact, when I wrote a story for Tom Paine called Kerry Won, after the 2004 smash and grab, the New York Times called me up, and they literally said, are you a sore loser? That was their first question. Second question was, are you a conspiracy nut? And, you know, they had no third question. But the next day now you have to understand, I'm reporting on BBC Television, the world's premier news network. And the New York Times front page story the next day was, Internet theories of Bush loss easily debunked. That's a quote of their headline. So they say you're from the Internet. So that makes you immediately a nut. It doesn't matter that, in fact, the story originated with BBC or the Guardian papers or something. It's on the Internet. In other words, the Times didn't filter it for you.
But now they want to shut
this
down.
This is very, very dangerous. Yeah, I mean, and I think that's why, by the way, that's why, you know, like I really give a big up and hope people do support KBOO. I mean, I come on for your fundraisers. For a darn good reason. We're not in fun drive now, but guys, I hope that you start kicking in. Do you have to really be reminded to keep this station alive? Do you really need a specific plea and pledge? You should be banging on the door saying, here, I'm breaking my piggy bank and leaving the pennies at your door. Please take them. Stay alive. I hope people understand what's at stake in keeping KBOO alive.
Well, I wanted to raise one other thing. I earlier in the show, I talked about something that was like an aha for me. I'm kind of dumb sometimes. I'm looking at this weapons-grade anthrax that shows up in these two liberal, well, sort of liberal, senators who might have opposed the Patriot Act, right? And it comes, I'm told, from Fort Detrick. And it suddenly appears only in their offices, these two Democrats. And these two guys flip their votes, you know, Daschle and
Leahy.
And Leahy. And I'm thinking, now, I'm not a conspiracist, but isn't that strange? Now, what's your take on that one, Greg Palast?
You can hear I'm already coughing. It's a
little anthrax there.
I got my own envelope of powder. So it's you know, how do I know? I can't take it all on because you'd go crazy completely if you take it all on.
I mean, so much. They're so busy everywhere.
I know that's one of the problems. You can't take it all on. That's why we have to kind of.
But you understand where I'm going with this, and what I'm arguing here is that this isn't a vicious, clever set of campaigns of a political nature with very busy guys who have no who are ruthless, who have no compunctions. This is genuine conspiratorial behavior by people who are, in fact, if not in name, fascists.
Well, remember, some of the fascists at least got elected. these guys are not elected. Let's keep that in mind. They were not. They were elected, but they didn't win the vote.
But you're not arguing with the name fascist, or are you?
Well, no. I mean, but you know, the thing is that the only reason I would argue with the name fascist is that it can get worse.
Thank you for that.
It can get worse, and so what's happened is I want to kind of save the term fascist for
when they take you away
coming next year, okay? And what I and my work now is to see if we can avoid that path. I think that there's still something in the American people. You know, it takes a while for the penny to drop for Americans. But anyway, I do have. Unfortunately, I got to get off because I've got to get actually back to the old to the grind of investigating. I do hope that people will go to my website, gregpalast.com, because I'm going to keep pushing out some new reports. Do catch that report that I just did from Venezuela and my report from Ecuador. and, you know, I'll catch up with you on June 5 when I'm in Portland for KBOO.
Well, in fact, if you can, the week before that, we'd like to get you back on the air ahead of time, if that's possible. Don't make a commitment.
Well, now that you've embarrassed me by asking me on the air, how can I say no?
Oh, cool.
I gave. Yeah, absolutely. Okay,
we'll Greg Plast, thank you very much.
Hey, take it easy.
Bye-bye.
You know, he's really good, man.
He is good. History, did you hear it? Just like we're always talking here.
History.
History.
I don't know much about history.
Well, you should.
Oh, man.
See, I
teach history.
It's only...
Wait, I teach history.
It's only in a... I know you do.
That's what they pay me for.
It's only in a... Yes, Joe Uris, ladies and gentlemen. Joe
history,
Uris.
History, man.
It's only in a climate that is ignorant of history that phrases like, they hate us for our freedom, carry any weight whatsoever.
Well, I don't think it carry... See, what these guys did was they made us all so... Well, not us, you and I, but made so many people so frightened and created a climate that is very easy to manipulate. And they never stopped. They never stopped on that. They kept heightening the level of terror and fear in the American people, totally irrationally. And they successfully invented the Saddam Hussein nightmare, which has got you know, people say, oh, it's psychological because daddy didn't finish the job or something. No, Greg Plast and many others say very simply, look, it's about, in his case, he points out, and I think he's right, holding the oil off the market to control the price of that oil, to control the role of the foreign debt, essentially to allow this whole corrupt system to continue to function in the manner that it is.
Yep.
And they have an ideological dimension overseas, which is the U.S. must rule the world. And locally, that is nationally, their plan is still the Norquist plan, to drown the government, to literally provide such bad service, so little service, so deceitful a service that the American people lose all faith in the possibility of decent government and possibility of decent services and turn away from all of that and into a kind of paranoid, delusional state of, I got to do it myself, but I don't know how.
Buttressed by unthinking nationalism.
You know, folks, we are taking calls again because it is talk radio, and the number to call is 231-8187. If you're just tuning in, it's KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Joe Uris, that's Abe Proctor, and we want to hear from you.
And that whole list you just ran down, writ large, and as we've mentioned on this program before, writ large, this is all watching over the transition of political and economic power from the hands of the nation state, that is, we the people, to the hands of the emerging transnational executive corporate ruling class, who governs beyond borders, who transmits capital anywhere at will around the world, who can rely on taxpayer-funded military protection for their exploitative endeavors wherever they should happen to do them.
Taxpayer-funded military protection, including Blackwater.
Yes, including mercenaries.
Including mercenaries who don't have to obey the rules at all.
Okay.
Okay.
I got a couple things I want to line up here, and then I want to take some calls on this.
Okay.
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 Two things recently came to my attention. First, there was a report on 60 Minutes Sunday night. Did you catch this one?
I caught some of it.
This was an interview with a man by the name of Tyler Drumheller, who was no less than the chief CIA spook in Europe and the Near East during the buildup to the Iraq War.
And what did he say?
He was the man on intelligence about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction program.
Yeah.
Now, he said on the 60 Minutes interview, he said that most people in the intelligence community didn't think there was anything at all to this Niger uranium story. That's what this is what Joseph Wilson came public with.
Right.
This is what President Bush mentioned in his State of the Union address. This is what led directly to the indictment of Scooter Libby. Now,
wait a minute. Don't forget, it's okay if Bush tells a secret because then it isn't a secret anymore.
Right, but it goes a little deeper.
Yeah.
So Drumheller says, nobody in the intelligence community believed any of this. But as soon as we told this to the White House, he says, they said, we don't want that anymore. This is about regime change now. It's not about intelligence. So you need to come back with what we want. Now, for those of you who have been paying attention, and I think those of you who listen to the show have been paying attention, this is not the first revelation of this kind to come out. This is Revelation 5, 6, or 7. We had... former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill come forward and say that Iraq was on Bush's radar even before September 11th.
Fired him.
We have Rumsfeld's memo on the afternoon of September 11th asking if we can link Saddam Hussein to this.
Ignored it.
We have former intelligence chief Richard Clark telling us after his resignation that all the president wanted was intelligence somehow connecting September 11th with Saddam Hussein.
Just him.
All of this has come out before. Why is this significant now? Because now public opinion has turned against the president. Now people are paying attention. And now we have evidence that two intelligence reports that came forward about the Iraq war, the first from the Senate, headed by Senator Roberts of Kansas. We've talked about this before. The second from the Rob Silberman Commission, which was the, quote, independent commission set up by the president of the United States to look at this. This guy, Drumhiller, talked to the Rob Silberman Commission.
And the CIA guy.
The CIA guy. The head spook in Europe and the Near East.
Yeah.
Talked to this commission.
Yeah.
Told them what I just talked about.
Yeah.
But the commission didn't include it in their report.
Why not?
That's a very good question.
Hmm.
And you know who sits on this commission, among other people?
Tell me.
One senator from Arizona, John McCain, who has presidential aspirations, who voted for the war in Iraq knowing that there was nothing there. Now, this is Mr. Straight Talk Express. This is a guy who's made a political career out of being an alleged maverick, out of being somebody who swims against the tide, somebody whose political integrity is all-encompassing. But it's just a bunch of crap. McCain knew about this all, supported it all, and those of you who think that he might be a viable alternative to the do-nothing Democrats, don't buy it. If McCain gets the political or the Republican nomination in 08 and you're tempted to vote for him, don't. He's a fraud.
Okay, and what else? You had another thing?
I did. I'm leading into this.
Okay.
Now, a little bit more on what Drumheller said. The CIA managed to turn Iraq's foreign minister under Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein's foreign minister became a CIA plant during the waning days of the Hussein regime. Told the CIA that there were no weapons of mass destruction programs, that there was no nuclear program, that Hussein might have wanted to have one, but he didn't, that the inspectors had found everything and destroyed everything, and there was nothing there. But nothing happened. Nothing came out in the Silberman Rob report. Nothing came out in the Senate Intelligence Committee's report about this. So, you know, those of you, again, as, who have been paying attention, this is the fifth or sixth time we've learned about this. But maybe this time it'll stick. So, where does this lead me now?
Yeah, where does this leave you now? What are you going to do about it? Huh?
I'm getting there. This leads me to a brilliant article in this, the most recent edition of Vanity Fair magazine.
Vanity Fair, I can't use it because of the perfume.
Oh, okay. Well, actually, that's not true. On vanityfair.com.
Oh, I can use
that. This is where
that.
You're going to find this.
Okay.
You remember a guy named Carl Bernstein was a prominent reporter in the 1970s?
Watergate.
He wrote a little story about Watergate.
Watergate.
Yeah. Carl Bernstein has written an exhaustive catalog of this administration's sins and has, in my opinion, proposed a solution that will satisfy everybody.
What's that?
It's the middle ground between people who are screaming for the immediate impeachment of the president and those people who are do anything to protect him. He proposes calling Senate hearings like the ones that led to the downfall of Richard Nixon.
Wait a minute, these cowardly senators?
These cowardly senators. This is, I'm going to quote from the Bernstein.
It's like the Roman Senate in the Republic, in the Empire, man.
It is, man. In terms of imminent meaningful action by the Congress, this is Bernstein, however, the question of whether the president should be impeached or less severely censured remains premature. More important, it is essential that the Senate vote, hopefully before the November elections and with overwhelming support from both parties, to undertake a full investigation of the conduct of the presidency of George W. Bush along the lines of the Senate Watergate Committee's investigation during the presidency of Richard M. Nixon.
Not going to happen.
Probably not, because back in Watergate, the Democrats controlled the Senate. But Bernstein makes a very, very important point here. He says that before the Senate Watergate hearings commenced, Republicans were unanimous in their support of the president. By the time the hearings were over, it was pretty hard to find a Republican who would stand up for the president. There's something about an official sanctioned congressional inquiry with subpoenas, with witnesses under oath, documenting the transgressions of an administration that helps to solidify public opinion. The one vindication, Bernstein writes, of the Watergate era was that the system worked. It got rid of a corrupt administration. And right now we are reaching that same test. And Bernstein says without Senate hearings like we had in Watergate, the system won't work.
Well, I think it's more corrupt than that. I think it would be great if those hearings took place, but I have such doubt about the moral authority, the courage, the patriotism of current members of Congress, particularly of the U.S. Senate, that I just am dubious. But I want it to happen. I think the hearings are a good approach. I'm just dubious. I got to tell you some stuff, though. This is business. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM dial with Joe Uris and Abe Proctor. But at 9 o'clock on Between the Covers, host Jim Schumach interviews Kay Gibbs, author of The Life Around Me by Ellen Foster. At 9:30 on Words and Pictures, here Dan Pararo, surrealist painter, illustrator, and cartoonist. He's best known for his cartoon, Bizarro, which I happen to love. At 10, Terry Wiley of Oregon Tradeswomen discusses how that organization helps promote success for women in the building trades and other trades. Also, Dan Denver of the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee talks about NAFTA-style free trade and immigration rights. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, members of Artists Repertory Theater discuss Assassins by Stephen Sondheim. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, my absolute most favorite show, Antonia Yuhas talks about her new book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. And the director of a newly released film called The Peace Patriots talks about the activities of anti-war activists before and after the Iraqi invasion. All this and more on KBOO.
All right.
All right. Hey, let's go out to some of our callers. Tim, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Joe?
All right.
Hey, I'm going to go back to what you were mentioning about John McCain,
mm-hmm.
because of people's lack of memory on history of what people have done in the past. You know, John McCain was like the rah-rah boy back when he was running against Reagan for the Pharisee right, for this whole right-wing, you know, religious conspiracy thing. And I brought that up to somebody, and they said, I don't remember that. I said, yeah. You have to remember what these people said in the past. So, you know, I'm just kind of trying to help reaffirm the fact that this guy is not somebody you can trust.
Yeah, you know, he just went kiss-kiss with the religious right just the other day.
Yeah, I heard about that.
He's kissing and making up real quick with those boys.
So, and something I didn't hear you mention was the Blackwater mercenaries down in New Orleans.
Yeah, we mentioned that.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Well, just in passing, though.
I walked out of the room at the time, huh?
No, just in passing.
Okay.
Because there's so much.
Yeah, right. No kidding. Okay, well, I'll get off and let somebody else.
Sure. Thanks a lot for the call, man. I want a quick mention. Lord Buckley's 100th birthday, man. Lord Buckley, the hippest dude. That's the snapping of the fingers.
Right,
hippest dude ever. This April 20th at the Church of the Living Swing, man. At 6th and Prescott, 6 p.m. till whatever. This is a very hippo-rama thing.
What?
Lord Buckley, you know. I mean, Jesus the hipster and all that.
Sure,
know.
Sure.
Cool. And, of course, Sunday at 1:30 to 3 o'clock, the rally for Durfer, for justice, for helping the people there at Pioneer Courthouse Square.
All
okay.
right.
Now,
cool.
back to the show.
Okay, so
back to the show.
All right. So why are Senate hearings, why is that a satisfactory solution? I know everybody wants to see this man impeached, but it's not going to happen because of the way because of that Constitution thing. Now, we can't successfully agitate for impeachment right now because of the way Congress is aligned. But what we can do is inundate the Senate with letters and phone calls and emails calling for a Senate investigation of the conduct of this administration. And how do you want to do that? Go to www.senate.gov. You can visit the webpage of each and every senator. Each and every senator has a comment page you can link to, and you can tell them to immediately call for a full investigation of this administration.
I think you should do that. I think you should fight on every front. I think people, even our audience, are too lazy about the dangers to America and to democracy and to the interests of working people everywhere. I really believe that if you don't do everything you can, you are part of the problem rather than part of the solution.
Here's Bernstein again. As with Watergate, the investigation of George W. Bush and his presidency needs to start from a shared premise and a set of principles that can be embraced by Democrats and Republicans, by liberals and centrists and conservatives, and by opponents of the war and its advocates. That the President of the United States and members of administration must defend the requirements of the Constitution, obey the law, demonstrate common sense, and tell the truth. Obviously, there will be disagreements, even fierce ones, along the way. But this is the way. I think.
The lay. All right. I want to hear. We want to hear from all of you out there. It's Talk Radio after all. 231-8187. And who? Lee, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, I agree that we are all too lazy, but I think I'm just a little bit cynical because I'm wondering, you know, if we all rise up, isn't, you know, are we going to just get hit with bird flu? I mean, don't they proud that that's just going to be, you know, one more thing to keep us down? And, you know, I think the Senate, they probably all got some call in the middle of the night that said, hey, man, you know, you act up and you're going to get the Paul Wellstone plane, you know.
That is very cynical.
It's very cynical, and at the same time, don't you have those thoughts that,
well, sure, but if you function,
have the next thing waiting for us. I mean, it has to be such critical mass. It has to be, you know, the general strike that goes on for a week. I mean, how can we rise up?
Lee.
Yeah.
I understand what you're saying, and you're half kidding, half serious, but listen, if they take the position you take, then we are essentially giving in way.
And actually, I mean, I'm moved to fight, and I know as the days go by, I'm going to fight more and more.
Fighting's fun.
I just described to the paradigm that you can't fight bad and overcome it. You have to set up your own separate paradigm of good. And I think that if more of us do more of that, which is actually the latest issue of Vanity Fair has that whole green thing about, you know, yeah, we're here, but we can do more starting now. And I think that's the idea, is doing better and different.
Oh, I agree. The only thing stopping me from reading the actual magazine is the perfume ads.
I know. It's disgusting.
It really is. But, you know, it's a magazine for all people, and the sort of people, men and women, that put perfume all over themselves.
Yeah, I know. I know, but I think it's fun because, I mean, they're one of the one commercial kind of venues that is still trying to do good in their own
yeah,
way.
Yeah, owned by the same people, of course, as own the New Yorker.
Okay.
Listen, I want to give others an opportunity.
Okay,
thank you, Lee.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot, Lee. Okay, let's go to our next. Mike. You're on the air.
What's
Mike?
What's up, Mike? Hello.
Mike.
Yeah.
Hey, good morning.
Am I on?
Yeah, yes. You are. Be careful.
Oh, great. Okay, so, you know, it's about thinking about the technique for rising up.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and a lot of times we don't talk enough about that. I mean, what are the means and technique for building a movement?
That's those are good points.
Yeah. I've been, you know, anti-war activist ever since my mom was one in the 60s, you know, and I've watched, you know, how things get done. And it seems like one of the most natural formations that people create are small groups around, you know, of neighbors and friends,
mm-hmm.
that meet regularly, that undertake political action. And it just seems to be a natural formation that people, create when they're doing grassroots organizing. And so people should think about that, you know, how to meet around a kitchen table with your friends on a regular once a month and do something political. But don't just do it yourself. Do it. Make sure that everything you do is collective, that you bring in other people, and you can start by just meeting in your living room, and then you can move to holding community events and bringing more people in.
No, I think that's a great idea. I would add to that, though, that because of the internet and because of the telephone, every one of us, if we took like a half an hour every other day to make a few Senate calls and so on, would actually improve things.
No,
but I definitely agree with you.
And I'm involved with the Rural Organizing Project, and that's basically how we're formed all over the state, is with these little, we call them human dignity groups, but they're really that kind of group. And, you know, in May we're going to have a caucus, and we're going to talk about how making all, you know, because we've got, you know, people doing peace stuff all over the state and all these little towns. So now we're going to try to talk about, well, let's make sure we know who's in our congressional district, which groups are in our, and act collectively.
That's a very good idea. In fact, one of the biggest problems we all have is what the Catholics call the sin of despair. And
right.
That happens because we all feel so isolated. In fact, we are, at this point in American history, the majority. We are the majority. And American people all over the country are waking up and realizing what needs to be done at some level. What they don't have is an overall understanding, a historical perspective, and from that, a reasonable ideology for building true democracy in America.
And also just a platform to act from. because like you were saying with your interview, which was great, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes it's so, you know, they're coming at you with one thing after another, blah, 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 one crime after another. So you have to have a platform and a, for which your actions come from.
Absolutely. And context is so important. You know, there's a lot of argument in the left about conspiracy versus this versus that. All of that is important, but it's actually irrelevant to the real problem, which is not a conspiracy so much as it is that, well, maybe you want to call it a conspiracy, the fact that a group of fascists have united with a group of really angry fundamentalist Christians who do not believe in the teachings of Jesus, as far as I can tell. And those two groups have come together around an imperialist agenda abroad, an oil-based economy, and on top of that, an effort to hold down and essentially cripple American people in their own personal interest. And once you got that clear in your head, everything else follows from it, and you can work and actively participate in organizing communities. You don't need to agree on every issue. All you need to do is understand that and go from there.
And also remember that, you know, all you said I agree with, but also that that ship you just described is hitting the rocks right now.
And it is. It is.
Good chance that people are going to be looking for some alternative.
We have to let you.
Up in that.
Absolutely. We have to let you go. We thank you very much. This is KBOO 90.7 on the FM dial. This is Joe and Abe, Abe and Joe. We want you to stay tuned for the radio zine. Stay tuned to the station. Keep on struggling because the struggle is fun.
Para que vuele bien lejos, lejos de ti y de tu amor. Aunque tenga que sufrir, no me voy a arrepentir, pero voy a maldecir el haberte conocido. Ya mañana Dios dirá, pero hoy tengo que cambiar para ser feliz conmigo. Voy a quitarme el anillo y también quitaré la marca que me ha dejado, que a mi dedo le ha quedado, con eso la borraré. Voy a soltar.